This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. It's episode 352 of the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast. And for this episode, I'm in Boston on a trip that I'd wanted to make, talking to Chris Loring from Notch. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome back to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
This episode started with an email, and Chris was responding to a story that we wrote, or that Joe Stang wrote on Czech approach to lager brewing in Craft Beer and Brewing magazine last year. And just had some thoughts about the way that the story of Czech brewing has been told, and wanted to kind of, wanted to broaden the conversation that oftentimes we get a singular view of what Czech brewing looks like, and the reason why things are the way they are through the Czech brewing process. Chris studied brewing in Prague and went to school there, and has a lot of experience brewing Czech beer. Naturally now, having been to the Czech Republic and visited lots of breweries there last year, my perspective is different on that Czech approach to brewing. And so we thought we would get back together and talk again about Czech approaches to brewing. Although I don't know if we talked as much about the Czech approach the first time we did this, right?
No, I think it was more one of my favorite beers, and a lot of them were from the Czech Republic.
Sure, yeah. Sure. So throughout this episode, we're going to talk about the way that different Czech brewers brew beer, because I think that's one of the interesting things about the entire Czech brewing culture, the diversity there, the different approaches that brewers take, the reasons, the why, and building things. And of course, I am just using this as a glorified excuse to come up to Boston and drink some Notch beer and sit down across from you in person, because the last time we talked, it was pandemic time. We had to do it remote, and I didn't get to enjoy this. So here we are. We're going to dive through that. We're going to talk about everything from your 37 IBU 10 degree and your 45 IBU 12 degree with differing approaches to hops, to also the kind of way that you build balance, bitterness, but also softness, also fullness. And we're going to talk about the way that, your experience through different Czech brewers approaching those through different angles and different directions. Because again, Czech brewing is not a monocultural thing. As we have found in talking to Czech brewers, it's a very, there are lots of different approaches to making compelling beers that people want to drink lots of. And so that's what we're going to do in this episode. Before we do that, at G&D Chillers, they always strive to build great chillers. Partner with them as you build great beer. But don't take it from me.
Hey, this is Josh Erickson of Jafunkta Brewing in Mandeville, Louisiana. The team at G&D were a critical part of our 10X expansion, always just a phone call or email away. And thanks to their superior equipment, technology, and documentation, commissioning our new chiller was smooth and straightforward. Now we can't wait until we need to upgrade our existing chiller.
That's right. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring on your new G&D chiller. And ProBrew is changing the game at this year's CBC in Las Vegas. As part of ProMoc Craft Beer Solutions, they're presenting a holistic approach to craft brewing operations. Through their display of animations, holograms, and machinery, they'll be highlighting how they can advance every aspect of your production line. Visit go.probrew.com/CBC24 or contact them at contactus@probrew.com to schedule one-on-one time with one of their subject matter experts at booth 1783 at this year's show. ProBrew, brew your beer. Also, you might have heard of Old Orchard, but have you heard of their newest flavors? Berry Blend, Blood Orange, Lemonade, and Tart Cherry are the latest additions to their lineup of flavored craft juice concentrate blends. Old Orchard's R&D team can also formulate custom blends unique to your needs. To learn more and request your free samples, head on over to oldorchard.com/brewer. All right, Chris. So last time we talked on the podcast, we got your history. We got some of that background. But you mentioned you studied brewing in Prague. Tell me about studying brewing in Prague.
I mean, it was enlightening. First thing I want to say is I by no means am I an expert in Czech brewing.
None of us are.
I've accumulated experience and knowledge, sure, and a point of view, But you know, this all comes, you know, from that. And so I don't want to come out saying this is the way or be dogmatic, right? I just, I have a viewpoint of it, and I've just seen how the American brewing scene has evolved over the last, you know, I'd say 15 years with Czech Lager, and it's been very interesting to me. So I think that was the email that started this all.
100%. And I think that should go for every podcast episode we do. We don't attempt definitive statements or the end of any conversation through any individual podcast episode. That would be insane and crazy. All we do is have conversations with brewers that have their own perspectives on these things and try to tap into that and share that out there with the broader brewing world so that all of these perspectives, that people can take what they want from those conversations, work it into their own process, build that kind of perspective. And, you know, anyway, so this isn't the last word on it. It sure shouldn't be. And we would never want to approach it that way. This is another opinion based on your experience, your perception, and your, you know, the, what you have learned.
I appreciate your career. Yeah. So it was interesting to me because I've been brewing professionally since 1993 and only got on the lager in 2010. And that was really because of a trip I took to the Czech Republic in 2005 that kind of sat in my brain for a long time. I love low ABV beer. I like to drink multiple half liters over a long period of time. And that's still not, I think, in tune with where American craft beer has been or going. And that's okay, because we need different viewpoints. So I had accumulated brewing, you know, experience, personal experience, that informed how I brewed and the kind of Czech lager that I brewed. And so going to the university we went to in Prague for this brewing course was enlightening to me because it reinforced, you know, what I knew, and two, it also opened up new avenues in terms of, you know, how brewers do things either through just happenstance. And it was fascinating to me. And it really opened up a world of Czech brewing that I didn't hear from brewers and I didn't see from experience. And it was a different viewpoint that I saw that brewers coming back from the Czech Republic for the first time and implementing beers in Czech culture that were a little bit at odds with what I'd experienced and learned, you know, through coursework. So that was interesting to me. So the email kind of prompted this conversation that the beers being produced in the United States right now that are Czech influenced, I think sometimes are wildly uninformed.
Hmm.
Sometimes are spot on, but that kind of reflects Czech beer in general, right?
Sure. Sure.
It's
you're saying some of the Czech brewers themselves are spot on and some are all over the place.
Some things are not by intention, right?
And you know, the Czech Republic is like every country where that range exists in the United States amongst IPA brewers in the same kind of way that it exists in the Czech Republic amongst pale lager brewers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a category. And you have this wide set of examples of a style or a beer that we want to be monolithic and we want to check all the boxes of what that means. And in my experience, Czech pale lager, Pilsner if it's brewed in Pilsen, is not a style. It's a category. And if you come back from that country having Budvar, Pilsner Kel, and maybe one or two others, you've not experienced what Czech lager is about. You've only scratched the surface of what that country produces. They can be dry, which I think is an outlier, but mostly they're malty, right? Mostly they're hoppy. But even within that, you're going to get such different expressions, if you will, of that style. And you see brewers coming back wanting to make crispy boys and something that's really dry and bitter. And that's not Czech lager, you know? And I've just wondered why there was this preconceived notion of what a Czech lager needs to be. And like, you know, BJCP has to contextualize everything. And a lot of American brewers want to contextualize everything and check the boxes. And this is what this beer should be. But it's not that simple. It's very nuanced from how you brew the beer, in terms of source of ingredients, mashing procedures, fermentation procedures, fermentation management to packaging. It's all those variables produce a beer that has a wide range of flavors and aromas. And sometimes those process decisions are either intentional or not intentional, lead a beer that is really wonderful or sometimes not so wonderful, depending on what you like. If you like diacetyl, man, that country's for you, right? But there's also really good expressions of beers there without diacetyl. And sometimes I think it's not by design. Sometimes I think it's by happenstance.
Interesting. So there may not be as much intention behind some of the piece, even though there's just a general kind of cultural blindness. I don't know if we need to get deep into the cultural attachment to diacetyl, but let's talk a little bit about the process pieces, that you think, that you've mentioned to me that lead into that, that it's not, there are process choices that brewers are making that either do or don't, lead to ultimate expression of diacetyl in those beers. Walk me back through, the way the different Czech brewers tackle those kinds of technical processes, and then of course how you do it too.
Right. So the foundational thing I think of Czech brewing is decoction, right? And that, in the Czech Republic, if you're going to produce beer, you're decocting.
Right. To where they even don't even think about decoction as a separate thing that you wouldn't do.
Correct.
It's just brewing, and brewing means decoction.
Right. And decoction means that you're going to create flavors and aromas that otherwise can't be achieved. And I don't care if you think you can do it otherwise. Yeah, you can. Modern malts will allow you to produce beer, to create sugar and ferment without decoction. But, decoction is, basically creating melanoidins, and you can't do that otherwise. Yeah, you can get melanoidin malt, but that substitute doesn't work. I've tried that. That's just trying to do something as a shortcut. First off, the Czechs are great at not discarding processes that lead to very great beer, because modern technology has allowed you to forget about that through either labor savings or cost savings. The Czechs don't want to hear that. You need to do it. That's a wonderful thing that they've kept that. Open fermentation is a big thing. Not everyone does it, but open fermentation and the reasons why, an open fermenter, provides a yeast environment to create flavors and aromas that otherwise you can't achieve. That is still pretty relevant and prevalent. However, the fermentation procedures are very interesting to me, and they mimic to some extent the Franconian brewers in that how you take a beer from a fermenter into a lagering tank and how you are dealing with temperature and yeast cell contribution to reduce diacetyl. And this is where it gets into kind of the minutiae, right? Where most Czech brewers arrest fermentation before the beer is completely fermented out. And it could be a degree Plato, it could be 5 degrees Plato above where it's supposed to be. And it's, moved into a horizontal lagering tank, and it's left to sit for a number of months or weeks. And the yeast sometimes does its job and, takes the diacetyl precursor, turns it into diacetyl, and reabsorbs it into the yeast cell. Sometimes it doesn't. Right. And it's not too far from what a lot of the German brewers do in terms of doing the same kind of procedure. But there has to be a repeatability there to have a consistent outcome. And I just haven't seen the repeatability a lot in the Czech Republic. I've seen a lot of brewers have variability in what they're producing and for reasons I don't understand. And this is some of the coursework that I did. And my professor was from, he's ex-Pilsner Kell, and I had long conversations with him about why do Czech brewers have such great variability. Even among the same brewer with diacetyl that's produced. And he just shrugged his shoulders and didn't even want to get into the conversation. So that in itself, spoke a lot to me about Czech brewing, and that a lot of it's not by intention. It's just a result. It's not to say German brewers are necessarily better. We've discovered that some, German brewers will have diacetyl in their beers for the same reasons. They didn't have the same conditions that were needed to have, diacetyl basically reduced during the latter stages of fermentation. And then that produces, diacetyl within that beer.
So talk to me about that process.
So in diacetyl production, or for diacetyl reduction, I should say. So in fermentation, you'll have precursors known as acetolactate. And that precursor is not something that we can smell or taste unless it's oxidized. And in the brewing process, you will have an environment where you're not going to oxidize the beer in your fermenter or your lagering tank. So it can be there and you don't know it. So acetolactate will be, that precursor will turn into diacetyl and then reabsorb by the yeast cell just through a natural state of low pH, and then time and temperature. So if your temperature is at a certain range and you have enough time, it's going to naturally take care of itself. You won't even know it. And there's a way to test this to make sure that that pathway is complete. If you don't test for it, you're kind of at the whim of the yeast actually doing its thing without you knowing about it. So let's take an example. You produce a beer, you arrest fermentation with like a degree Plato left to go, and you put it in your lagering tank, and you don't have enough yeast cells in suspension, and you package that beer, right? It still has the precursor present. Over time, that beer will oxidize, and that acetolactate will then turn into the acetyl in the beer and present itself as butter, either in package or through draft, right? And you wouldn't know that unless you did test for it.
A beautiful way to explain why many brewers are like, well, my beer didn't have diacetyl in it.
Right.
And then it does.
And then it does, because it didn't. It had the precursor. So you need to make sure the precursor goes to diacetyl, and diacetyl is then reabsorbed by the yeast cell. I think one of the benefits of having lagering tanks where you can, you know, park it there for 3 months was that this was going to naturally take care of itself, and that if you have enough yeast cell present, pH is there, and the temperature is such that, you know, the yeast can still work, it will reabsorb that. But if any of those conditions aren't there, you're going to have a beer with diacetyl. So American brewers, this kind of leads into, like, I think why Czech beer can be so wonderful, and why American versions of lager can be somewhat homogenized and not so great. I mean, good beer, but not great beer. So a lot of American brewers abide by a fermentation procedure where you ferment at, say, 55 degrees. And near the end of fermentation, you raise that temperature. And raising that temperature, you know, accelerates this process of acetolactate turning into diacetyl and being reabsorbed by the yeast cell. And so then at the end of that, you can just crash that beer. You're definitely through the diacetyl rest. You've tested that it's not there. And then you can crash that beer and serve it. Yeah, you've reduced the amount of diacetyl in that beer, and you've got it to a point where you're not going to have butter. But that beer is not really distinctive, because raising that temperature and crashing that beer has basically just quickened the process of making lager. And if there's one thing that we've learned about lager is you got to be patient with it. And the more time you give it, the better it's going to be. And the quicker you make it, the less distinctive it's going to be. It's still going to be a good beer, just not going to be as distinctive as it could be. So, you know, if you are able to take your beer into a lagering tank at the right temperature with the right amount of yeast cells in suspension at the right pH, as long as you give it time, you're going to get there, right? But I think some brewers just arrest fermentation in the Czech Republic and they don't realize what's happening, right? That they have a production schedule that they hit, and there's not a metric to reduce that diacetyl, right? And then you
have sometimes that production schedule is the thing. They're not as cognizant of the fact that all of those pieces need to always execute in order to achieve that outcome, which is why, again, like you say, you see variability, you know, we see that all, like, oh, I got diacetyl in this one. Well, I didn't get any, you know, like it seems to come and go, but it also seems to come in the busiest seasons. And then maybe not appear as much in the wintertime, you know, when things are a little bit slower, which suggests that there's absolutely that kind of production element to it.
Yeah. If there's one thing that you're going to, will benefit diacetyl reduction is time. So at Notch, we have a schedule where we never raise the temperature for a diacetyl rest, because I felt that had a negative impact on the beer flavor.
Negative impact?
There's a character you get when you wait, and there's a character you get when that yeast naturally does its thing and you don't raise the temperature. The beer just isn't as refined. It's not as clean. I think that's the raise of temperature. Like, yeah, you've done your primary cold, but I still think when you raise that at the end of fermentation, you're allowing the yeast to create certain esters that otherwise wouldn't be there. And they're not bad esters. They're just not what we're looking for into making a distinctive beer. I think especially if I'm going to bring 3470 into the conversation. So, you know, the classic...
Here's the fun hot take. Yeah.
Here's the classic 3470 yeast that a lot of brewers use, and it's a workhorse. And when used in a way that tries to accelerate the process to get beer out quickly, I think that yeast is really, it presents itself as not great in terms of its character. And then it becomes this, to me, I can taste that beer in a way like, all right, these are beers that were produced by a brewery that's trying to get beer out quickly with 3470. 3470 can be wonderful if treated properly, but a lot of brewers use 3470 and they look up the American Lager Schedule. Greg Noonan was an amazing brewer. He wrote a book that I don't like. His lager fermentation schedule, I think, is not advantageous to making distinctive lagers. It's really good at making lagers quickly, right? And part of that process is, again, that ferment at a 55-degree range, raise it to 60, diacetyl is gone, chill it, package it. And I just don't think that makes distinctive lager.
I want to dig in on this because I think that's an interesting point to make, that you can make good lager, but we're having a conversation about making great lager.
Yeah.
And both of those things are, you know, you can make perfectly good lager that fits within a production schedule and hits all the business needs, you know, but if you want to make truly great lager, then there are some other things that takes. I want to dig in a little deeper on that. Before we do that, streamline efficiency with Omega Yeast's Diastole Knockout Series. The DKO series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. The strains you know now better, available now for made-to-order pitchables at any volume. Contact Omega Yeast today at omegayeast.com. Also, ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. They're proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country, as well as equipment for distilling, cider making, wine making, and more. They know the ins and outs of the brewing and installation process and can design the perfect setup for you. Whether you're just starting out or looking to expand, contact them today at sales@abs-commercial.com to discuss your customized brewery needs. ABS Commercial, we are brewers. And if you're a brewer who's also interested in distilling, subscribe now to the Craft Spirits and Distilling Podcast, available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Hosted by Sydney Jones, head distiller for Few Spirits in Chicago, and Molly Troop, master distiller for Freeland Spirits in Portland, Oregon. This podcast explores the technical and creative processes behind great spirits through conversations with some of the leading distillers working today. It's everything you love about the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast, but focused on distilling. Click on the link in the show notes and give it a listen. All right, Chris, let's talk a little bit more about that. The 3470 gets it done. It makes good lager, makes it well in a repeatable way for a lot of brewers. But for you, you want something more.
Yeah, and I'll say you can make great lager with 3470. I've had them. They're available, but they're usually dictated by a solid process. And so our process at Notch, we don't think we make the best lager in the world. We try to make a distinctive lager that we want to do repeatedly, right? And you may hate it, but we know that we're making something that has distinction. And lager isn't there to be clean and to be crispy and dry and homogenous. It's there to have variability. And you know, if you have a Helles at one place, the Helles at the other place might be a little bit different, right? It doesn't mean it's going to be bad. It doesn't mean it's going to have diacetyl in it. It doesn't mean it's going to be sweet. It just means that it's going to be a little bit different because the house fermentation character or the way you mash will lead to these little subtle differences that we love among breweries. So at Notch, like, we're trying to make the best beer we can based upon what we want to do. Not like we're not out here like, hey, we make the best beer in the world. We don't. We make really good beer that we want to achieve a certain set of parameters and a certain set of aromas and flavors, right? And so we go about it this way. And we don't do the American fermentation schedule because we are going to duplicate a lot of other beers on the market. And that is just that the differentiation isn't going to be successful from us from a business standpoint. Right. And also isn't exciting to us as brewers because we geek out in process a little bit, and the process of making, you know, distinctive lager is a really fun one. So, we choose to use lager yeast that is more expressive, right? That isn't just a clean lager yeast. Clean lager yeast is boring to me because I want that yeast to participate in the flavor profiles. I want that yeast to bring an aroma. I want that yeast to bring a flavor, to play well with the melanoins that were created during decoction, to be able to attenuate to a level that is complete, but not, you know, going to scream through all the sugars that we've created and create a dry beer that's one dimensional, or even have, you know, expresses tannin or other unpleasant characters. So lager yeast, I think, has been in the United States thought of as being this, you know, monolithic, we got to produce beers a little bit like this because we need them to be crispy and dry. And that to me is not the lagers I've experienced in the Czech Republic and even Germany. You know, the crispy boys don't exist, right? They're not dry. Some styles may be a little drier, but that's usually through other factors and not through attenuation. I shouldn't say attenuation, because I've had some great, you know, full beers at, you know, 2.5 Plato from German brewers, and they taste very, very full. that's coming from other avenues.
You know? Sure, sure. What are some of those lager yeasts that you find add more character into these European style lagers?
I mean, there's two strains of yeast or two types of yeast, and Czech Republic uses yeast that, I mean, it's called a Saaz type. And then, you know, it's confusing because it's the same name as a hop, but it has nothing to do with that. And then, like a Pilsner Kell, a D strain or H strain would be considered that, or maybe the Budvar yeast would be considered that. And then in Germany, which I love their yeast, the Bavarian yeast there are great. I mean, like Augustiner or Andex, those types of yeasts are distinctive, right? They're going to give you flavors and aromas. And if you were trying to make something super clean, that's not the yeast for you, because they're going to give you something, bready, biscuit, all those overused descriptions we use for lager are really present there, but they're present for a reason, right? And the thing I love about both those yeasts are they react very strongly to brew house mashing schedules and temperatures. And one of the things we really do at Notch is we look at how mashing and mash temperatures influence the final beer in terms of, are you creating simple sugar or complex sugar? And then how much of each? And then that is going to result in a beer that's full or not so full, right? So, our 10 Plato Czech Lager, Tenor, our mashing schedule there is dictated that we want to really emphasize complex sugars, because we don't want that beer to dry out, because we couldn't have 37 IBUs in that beer. We need something to kind of support that. And so we have a mashing schedule that supports that. And then if we have a beer that's bigger,
what's that, what are some of the parameters of that mashing schedule that you focus on in order to create more of those complex, harder to ferment sugars?
So if you're going to be in the lower 140 range Fahrenheit, you're going to create more simple sugars.
Right.
And they're going to be easy to chew through by the yeast. If you're up around, 156 to 162, you're going to create more complex sugars. And the time you spent at that mash rest is going to really impact that. We never skip one of the, we rarely skip a beta or alpha, but we definitely manipulate how long we stay at that rest. Sometimes for an hour, sometimes for 10 minutes, depending on what we're trying to achieve. And just as a side note, through, the 8 years we've been doing decoctions here, and we've done thousands and thousands of decoctions, more is not always better. Triple decoction isn't always better than a single decoction based upon what your goals are. So our Tenor, we started as a triple decocted beer, but for those who do decoction of multiple decoctions, you realize that say you mash in at 143 and then you bring it, your decoction over to your decoction vessel, it stays at 143 for however long that other decoction needs to go through. So you really can't manipulate 2/3 of your mash at 143, the time, right? You can do it in your decoction kettle because you're stepping through those things pretty quickly before you come to a boil and then returning that to the main mash. But you just left that 143 rest for possibly an hour, right? And so you've created a very fermentable wort. So we've gone away from triple decoction in a lot of times, and we've done what's called an enhanced double decoction. And without a graph, it's really hard to explain that. But enhanced double decoction, basically you're taking, say we mash in at 143. We bring half of that over, and we go through our steps and then return them at certain times. Or we do the enhanced decoction later. So say your goal is to have a highly fermentable wort, you might change the mash schedule a bit, and when you pull a decoction and how much you pull and how much you return. Again, without a decoction graph,
okay,
with two axes, with time and temperature, it's really hard to show this, right? But we were able to manipulate that in a way that we found that, a triple decoction is not always the end all. Sometimes if you're able to do a double enhanced or even a single, you're able to manipulate your mash schedule in a way that is better for your goal. It's not better for marketing, because triple always sounds better, right? Triple decocted, great. Well, that doesn't mean anything to anyone, especially if the beer's not what you want. So
sure. And then the length of, like you said, the length of that decoction matters too. And I was talking to Eric Toft at Shinram. He was talking about how short their decoctions are, he's trying to accomplish, specifically, blowing up some of those sugars and then be done. It's a very, very short decoction process. Yeah. He gets there and then and they're finished. It sounds like it speaks to something similar that you're talking about.
Yeah. Again, depending on your goal. So if we have a bigger beer, if we're doing something that's, our star, one sure, of our star sure. beers, we want to accentuate the fermentability of that beer. So we might have a really long 143 rest, and our 160 may be like 5 minutes, you know? And so we have to do our mash schedule and decoction schedule to like eliminate a long rest at 160. So we have, you know, the most fermentability possible. You know, so it helps to have a system that has, you know, the capabilities of pulling multiple decoctions, not just a single for a mash off, you know? But the most, we talked about fermentability a little bit in that email. Decoction doesn't lead to fermentability. Mash schedules do. Decoction can be an aid, you know, depending on how your mash schedule looks. So that's a big part of achieving a result based upon a decoction schedule with a mash schedule to create the kind of sugars that you want. How do we get here?
Yeah. I want to talk about that because you also have some rather high finishing gravities, you know, for what people think about in terms of lager, even in your 10 and 12 degree beers. And you're achieving that through, you know, this kind of mash process. So I want to dig into a little bit on that. Before we do that, SS Brewtech was founded by a group of home and craft beer brewers dedicated to bringing an engineering first approach to brewery equipment. SS Brewhouses are used to formulate new beer recipes at some of the world's greatest breweries and are the cornerstone of many local breweries. To learn more about SS Brewtech's innovation list, head on over to ssbrewtech.com. Also, some brewers want their water profile to be that of their city, and that sounds great, except for one factor. Depending upon the city and day, the water quality can vary 40 to 50%, so a Monday brew can taste very different from a Thursday brew. Savvy brewers know this, since beer is like 95% water. The best method is to start with the same water every time, and reverse osmosis gives you that power. Visit uswatersystems.com for a free expert analysis. So all these pieces, you know, are connected. Obviously, you are, rather than arresting, you know, fermentation, you are trying to, you know, set it up in that mash to hit these finishing gravities with the yeast that you have chosen that expresses and operates in that certain kind of way, knowing, you know, and of course, it takes lots of experience with that yeast to know just how you need to balance those sugars in order to achieve the kind of fullness that you are trying to achieve in that finished beer, because you produce a 10 Plato Desitka that still finishes at 3 Plato or a little bit higher. Like, talk to me about how you take an approach to building that body in these beers, but in a way that doesn't come across necessarily as sweetness itself. They are still there. That was certainly a giant takeaway of drinking beer in the Czech Republic. These are not crispy boys. There is some fullness there, and yet there seems to be a lager dogma, especially as it's translated here to the United States, of that kind of dry, 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 dry. That's not your goal.
Right. And we got this conversation because of the yeast selection, right? And the yeast selection is highly influenced by the mash schedule. So beyond the yeast selection, when you get to the mash schedule, what's the goal? How much sugar do you want left in that beer? So we achieve it. Like, with Notch, we've taken what I think we've cherry-picked processes we like. I can't say they're the best. The processes we like from the Czech Republic and Germany, kind of melded them into our process to achieve a goal. And one of the things we don't do is we don't arrest fermentation. That terrifies me. I was a British brewer for 10 years, and we arrested fermentation because we put it into casks, and then you could scrub out the acetal and ferment within a cask and serve it. And that was very easy. So arresting fermentation is something just like I have an aversion to. It works in the Czech Republic if you have enough time. It worked. They do it in Germany too, where they arrest fermentation. They don't so much arrest fermentation. They move it from a fermenter into the lagering cellar and drop it to a temperature where the yeast is still active and can reduce diacetyl and maturate the beer. In Czech Republic, it seems like they like to really crash that beer, right? And so that diacetyl is not going anywhere. So rather than us crashing the beer and having these variabilities, and you know, we have a lot of lagering tanks, but we don't have, you know, communist era like capacity where there's, you know, a million lagering tanks we can park beer into. So we've chosen a pattern.
No, we're here at the Brighton Brewery, and it's a very small, very tight lager brewery here. Obviously, Salem's bigger than this one.
Yeah.
You know, but you're making lager and leaving it in tanks for a lot of time in a pretty small brewery.
Yeah, we have 8 lagering tanks, and you know, sometimes beer sits in there for, you know, a couple months. That's it's a lot of money being tied up. So We've chosen the pathway of a mash schedule dictating the remaining or finishing gravity, which is the remaining sugar, unfermentable sugar in the beer. And that keeps that for us, that's more repeatable. as long as yeast is behaving. Because I think it's really, really important if you're making Czech lager to have that malt character, that sweetness, if you will. It's a malt sweetness. It's not like this sugary sweetness. It's a malt character, malt sweetness that allows you to hop in these high rates, and it allows you to get a balance that, you know, includes bitterness and hop aroma and hop flavor without being overbearing and out of balance. And, you know, I think that's a big part of why we've been able to achieve, you know, a 37 IBU 10 Plato beer. You know, otherwise that might be really unpleasant, bitter, tannic, you know, et cetera. Yeah. And even our German lagers, we're probably less traditional with our German lagers, although they're well received and we like them a lot, because German lagers tend to be, have a higher attenuation. They're typically like 2.5. You know, German lagers tend to be in the closer to three, like, you know, 2.8, 2.9. And that may be splitting hairs, but we still like that kind of like malt character. The German brewers don't tell you anything until you've met them 20 times. And even then they give you one piece of information each time you see them. So I don't even know what they're doing still. and God love them. I think German beer is one of the best in the world, and the Franconia region just drives me nuts, because sometimes you have the beers and you look at yourself and like, I'll never be able to recreate this ever. You know, and that's good. That's good. There's beers out there like that. Yeah. So yeah, again, I guess to answer your question, we just try to target a finishing gravity and a manipulation of a mash schedule with the yeast selection to land where we need to be, and try to make that repeatable as much as we can.
That's really interesting to do a 10 degree, 37 IBU beer and have that still be reasonably dry and drinkable, even though, you know, it has what you can measure as a, you know, as still a pretty significant amount of sugar in it. Is there some magic to the way that you use malt to achieve that? I'm just, you know, do different malts express that sweetness flavor or even capture that fullness without it being tasted as a sweetness better than others?
So this is going to dovetail a little bit into, you know, the trip that a lot of American brewers have gone on with the, I think it's the Czech Department of Alcohol.
The Trade Ministry, yeah.
Trade Ministry. So the Czech Republic, good on them. Great ability to get business from U.S. brewers. They were paying for U.S. brewers to go over to the Czech Republic for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years and give them tours of certain facilities and you know, malt houses and breweries, et cetera.
A beautiful experience. And in full disclosure, Anna, a brewer here at Notch, was on the press trip last year that I was on, and Joe Stang was on with me and a bunch of other American brewers. And so it's something we've talked about a few times here on the podcast.
And I think it's a wonderful way to expose U.S. brewers, and it's been successful because, you know, Notch was kind of out alone for a while with brewing Czech beer, and people thought we were weird, and we had a beer called Cherné Pivo, and they would look at us like we had, you know, 12 heads. So now it's, you know, it's better to be part of a larger movement than being the only one, right? Always. Cause now, you know, we're recognized a little bit better to making good Czech lager. Before, people just thought we were some weirdos making beers that were obscure.
You're still weirdos.
Good.
You're just more well-known weirdos.
Great. So, you know, in that trip, you know, a lot of folks were exposed to, you know, a small slice of the Czech, you know, brewing community. And one thing I keep seeing is that brewers think that Czech Pilsner is a smash recipe, single malt, you know, single hop. And that was not my experience at all in the brewers I've talked to. And more, I find more predominant is that there's a small amount of Kara or Crystal in any pale lager. It could be Crystal malt, Kara Hell, Kara Pils, whatever. Something that has some unfermentable sugars in it that doesn't come from mashing. Small amount, 1%, 2%, maybe 3%. Hmm. And, you know, I think that's a big part of some of the Czech lagers. Some color comes from that, you know. Everyone thinks that
it's not just the decoction.
It's just not the decoction. Huh. So the contribution of decoction on color, I think, is overstated. Especially if you're using steam and not direct fire. Also, if you're using direct fire, you're going to get a little more caramelization than, you know, Maillard reaction,
sure,
melanoidin creation. You know, caramelization is going to be a lot more color. So those things are interrelated, but they're not the same. So I think what's overlooked by a lot of U.S. brewers is that Czech Pilsner is not a single single malt. And so if you have U.S. brewers using a single malt with a mash mixer, not even talking about decoction, mash mixer that can't step, then you're going to have kind of a one-dimensional thing happening here. You can't create sugars in a way that manipulating the mash, and you're going to get a pretty dry beer. And I think, you know, and then throw in 3470 yeast and, oh, Wow. Right. So I think, you know, I think one of the things that happens, if we don't get a clearer picture of how all the brewers are formulating beers, that we have this kind of small window into that. And I think Crystal or Cara, et cetera, we use a small percentage in just about every single one of our Czech lagers. We have a couple that are single, right? We just made our 14th anniversary beer, which is a 14 Plato beer because it's the 14th anniversary. It was 100% Czech Pils malt because you don't need anything at that Plato. Like, it would become sweet, right? But it, you know, at a 10 Plato beer, like, yeah, I'm an advocate, you know, throw 3% of something in there. And you're going to realize with decoction and all these other things that, you know, you're going to get a little bit more of that sweetness. And that's just not the magic bullet too, because I do want to touch on this. In my experience, or our experience at Notch, nothing is a magic bullet. One single thing is going to make your beer better. Brewers have said this forever. It's with every beer style. It's with every country. It is the sum of everything you do to make a great beer. It's probably 30 things. One thing isn't going to, you know, all of a sudden be like, oh, that we've solved this, right? It's 30 things. So, you know, crystal malt, Cara malt at a small percentage could be one little thing to help you get there.
Are there some, you know, flavors of specific ones that work? You know, I'm just curious about this, how that works, because again, that's all going to fit into your fermentation process with your yeast, you know, these kind of flavor elements that you're adding in through that process. Trying to unlock them through this mash process, you know, is going to create precursors that the yeast is going to work on and, you know, adjust flavors in various directions. You know, there's some way, how do you think about that, especially, you know, in terms of how then also, and we're just getting this multivariate equation gets more and more complex, because then you also layer in the flavors that the hops can add to that. And yeah. So, you know, I'm just curious about that. How do you think about that as you're designing a Czech lager recipe?
I used to be really protective of everything we did, and then as I get older, I don't care, because what am sure. I going to take? Am I going to take it to my grave? You know, so yeah. I'm more willing to share all that. I find that
perfect timing for me then.
Yes,
I caught you at a good moment.
I find, yeah, and I'm only 3 schnitz into this interview, so we're good.
We're going to go back and get all the true things 4 years from now on the next one.
My retirement interview. So
you ascribed all these characters to European brewers, and what you really meant is it's yourself.
Right? Yeah.
Just wow. Takes multiple visits to build the trust and get the things out. Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm more like them than I thought.
Yeah.
So I find that with lower gravity beers, you can use something like a lower Lovibond crystal malt with some degree of safety there. That's not going to become too much, because, you know, what's 2% of a 10 Plato grist is not a lot.
Right.
And that can contribute some of these characters that really, really help that beer. I wouldn't do the same in a 12 Plato. I would move to something that has less character, like a Carahel. Like you chew these things, like chew like a light crystal malt. You know, chew a Cara Pils or chew a Cara Hell, and you're going to see right away what the flavor contribution is. And as you go from crystal to Cara Hell to Cara Pils, you're going less and less flavor. You're just getting, you know, body and sweetness. And so I would say the higher the Plato, move away from crystal and move to like a Cara Hell, move to a Cara Pils, because those will give you that.
It's almost counterintuitive where you're, you know, because what you're trying to do is shift the balance to hop flavor and away from malt flavor, whereas that lighter, that 10 degree needs the malt character to really power it.
Yeah.
And then you're stepping away from it, which is, again, seems maybe a little different from the way that, you know, other folks might want that malt to hold up to the hops and think about the character of the character. But
yeah, I think with lager and pale lager in particular, that you don't want that to get in the way. I mean, you just want body. You don't so much want flavor. You just want that body, because you want that hop bitterness flavor to really come through. And if you're competing with some kind of crystal situation, it's like, you know, I mean, taste our Pull at Mave. That beer has a fair amount of Carrot Bohemian in it, which is a dark crystal malt at its core. And, you know, that beer's fairly well hopped, and it doesn't present itself the same way you would get with a Pilsner or a pale lager. You know, so it's a different goal,
right?
In terms for us, anyways, with a 12 degree Plato Pilsner versus or pale lager versus a 10 degree. So we don't want that crystal malt to get in the way. Again, say crystal malt, and people are thinking like, you know, oh my god, like terrible. Like crystal malts become like the bane of every, you know, U.S. brewer's existence. But in very, very, very small amounts, it can be a very useful tool.
You got to bring crystal back. Yeah, yeah. When it comes to base malt, you know, where do you or is that consistent between your 10 and 12 degree? You know, and do you find that there are parameters to your base malt that, that you, you know, that make for better pale lagers in this sense?
We've experimented over the years with different base malts for our Czech lagers. We've landed on Raven, which a lot of US brewers use now. We have used the Weyermann Czech floor malted as well. That has a different character. It's a great character. It's just different. It's a little fuller. The Raven malt tends to give us less fullness, not in a bad way. You know, just like it allows us to have, I think, a better balance. So the Raven malt we typically use for all of our Czech lagers. And then for our German beers, we typically use a Weyermann base malt, typically like a premium pils or a Barca, something like that. We'll mix it up a little bit for flavor, but you know, we tend to be true with the region and apply that malt or barley where it's grown to that beer. Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about fermentation too. You know, one of the key things that you do, while you don't have open fermenters per se, they are no head pressure, basically open fermenters, even, you know, or at least the net effect.
They have a loose fitting lid.
A loose fitting, exactly. And so, you know, when it comes to, you know, again, getting this kind of fermentation character through that, you definitely believe in that no head pressure, you know, open-ish, you know, type of fermentation approach, versus, although you move, you know, halfway through that fermentation from this open fermenter into a, you know, traditional cylinder conical to finish that fermentation, still keeping, you know, pressure off for a little bit and then spunding to capture that. Talk to me a little bit about that kind of hybrid or mixed approach to fermentation, how you figure out timing around that and what that lends the beer in terms of character.
Sure. I mean, the goal here in our process, which I'll get into a little bit, the goal is to give the yeast an environment where it's really happy, but also be practical in yeast harvesting and natural carbonation. And so, you know, this is something I came up with that was picking and choosing from Czech and German type of fermentation. And I believe people probably use what we do. I've never seen it, but it's based on, again, the practicality, but also wanting open fermentation and have a happy yeast. So we have an open fermenter. It has a lid on it. So there's no hydrostatic pressure. There's no CO2 pressure.
Right.
Everything goes off to atmosphere. It has a lid on it because we don't have a separate room. And then it's as wide as it is tall. So there's no hydrostatic pressure on the yeast. And so by the book, you know, if you read, you know, Narzis or Kunz or any of these, you know, German brewers, like, you know, that will allow the yeast to work in a way that is, it's almost like an ester encourager, you know, that it will give different esters. And it also gives off sulfur, like some of the gases you don't want, you know, those will go to atmosphere. So, you know, that is by the book, what's supposed to be happening here. The other thing that I think happens, and it was kind of an unintended consequence of doing this, but I've seen this, you know, through my British brewing background and open fermentation there, and I knew this happened, is that, you know, the trub or the cold break will get caught up in the Kreuzen. And as long as you can remove your beer, you know, from that Kreuzen before it drops back in or skim, you're going to eliminate what the Germans call brown scum or brown yeast. And they firmly believe, and if you've tasted cold break, it doesn't taste good. It's harsh. It's bitter. It's not rounded. It's just, you don't want it in your beer. So
it's proteins, and those proteins bind to polyphenols, all the things that make hazy IPA what it is, right? Except, you know, in this kind of perspective, it's actually interesting to see that some of those harsher polyphenols do bind with those proteins in that kind of scenario. And hey, if you can get them out of these, then they potentially create softer.
Yeah.
You know, correct. Softer expressions.
I think softness is really, understated in that, you know, it's really, you're trying to get rid of that really harsh kind of bitterness. You want something soft and so that, you know, it tastes good. And then that softness lends to being able to hop a little more, because then it's the hop bitterness coming through and not this, you know, cold break, you know, bitterness.
And that's why I think it was important to talk about that, because when you talk about a 37 IBU 10 degree beer, that seems a little crazy to a lot of people, but this is one of those other elements to that process of, you know, maybe pulling out some of that polyphenol that otherwise might, you know, if that was a purely closed fermentation where that gets reabsorbed into the beer, well, that definitely is expressing differently than it does through your process.
Right. And so the Germans handle this through a flotation tank, and they basically, when it comes out of the heat exchanger, you're throwing compressed air through a stone, sintered stone, into the wort, and this compressed air is creating this, you know, basically head of cold break in a foam, and then it's you know, moved off the bottom and left behind in that tank, so you're getting the cold break out. You could do the same thing in a closed if you waited 12 hours and dumped it off the bottom before fermentation started to, you know, basically recirculate the tank and get that back into solution. But we found with open fermentation, it's going to get caught in the Kreuzen. One of the reasons we move it at about under half gravity, so at 12 Plato, like around 5 degrees Plato, we'll move it out of the open into a closed because we're going to leave that behind. And that's not going to carry through the rest of the fermentation.
Just pull off the bottom of the fermenter that way. Well, I guess you probably pull yeast and then start pulling beer and then.
So the yeast we want is still in suspension. Right. At 5 degrees Plato, it's still active within the beer. It's still in suspension. A little bit will settle at the bottom, but we'll bring that over. We'll bring that over into a closed unit tank, and we'll spund it at that point. And so this allows us the practicality of creating natural carbonation. It also creates the practicality of then being able to harvest yeast off the bottom of the cone, where it's really hard to top crop from open fermentation lager. It's not going to happen. That allows us then to, you know, spund, and then we go through our fermentation process of, we typically ferment 9 to 10 degrees Celsius. Once we have determined that diacetyl is reduced to acceptable level, we then start bringing the gravity down to what we call a lagering temperature of 5 degrees C. And I've seen this go anywhere, especially not so in the Czech Republic, but in Germany, anywhere between 3 C and 7 C is where they like to keep this rest for a period of time. So the yeast is still active. For Germany at this point, they're still reducing diacetyl. For us, it's gone. We've already determined that. We could bring that down quicker, but again, I'm kind of paranoid of that method. So we make sure at, you know, 9 degrees, 10 degrees, it's gone. And then we bring it to 5. We let it sit there for 7 days. So the yeast can still kind of, you know, do its thing, harvest, drop it to, you know, the final lagering temperature, which is 0, and then rack it to, or move it to a lagering tank, a horizontal lagering tank. And we let it sit there for however long we need it to. You know, we typically do 6 week lagers, longer if required, 8 weeks. You know, our beer's ready when it's ready. You know, if our beer's not ready, we don't package it. And I know that sounds odd to some people, but if that beer's not clear, if the flavor profile is not there, we skip it. We let it sit there. We've let some beer sit for a long, long time because we just didn't think it was ready. You can call that, as a businessman, I'm probably really, really not smart, but the disadvantage or advantage of Notch is that it's a brewer owned a brewery. And so sometimes the decisions we make are not financially advantageous. They're more advantageous for the beer.
It's hard to quantify those long-term benefits of making every beer so amazing that everyone has a great experience with it and they don't know why they like the beer there so much, but they want to keep going back to drink it there. And so there probably is an upside to it too.
Well, that's the intent. Yeah. The intent is that
even
we're really
proud. Even if the P&L doesn't show it.
Yeah. The intent is that, is that we're really proud of what we do. And that we're happy with what we're pouring.
Sure.
And that we don't put something out that we're just like, oh, I can't wait for that tank kicks because we don't like that. I don't want to be in that situation. You know?
On the flip side, after about 3 months, there's some declining utility to even into excessive lagering.
I would say yes. At a certain point, you've reached all your metrics that you need to, and all your flavor profile goals. And sometimes over that, it just doesn't really benefit. And we had a beer that lagered here over the winter for 4 months. It's a great marketing thing to say on social media, but reality is it was just as good at 2 months, and it didn't really improve over those 2 months. We're slow.
Sure.
So we just let it sit, you know? There's been some work. I forget the brewing scientist who talked about, there is something that happens in lagering at 0 degrees at 2 to 3 months that can't be replicated. And I'll have to go dig that out. I read it a couple times and I haven't really thought much about it because that's just not a practical thing for us to shoot for. That can't be in our goals.
Sure. Well, another thing I want to talk to you, about before we wrap up is dark Czech lager. It's an interesting one. You make both seasonally a Černé pivo in the winter and a Tmavé in the summertime, or somewhat six months. And I am curious to hear you explain the difference between these two. What is, you know, as you approach it, and again, within the Czech Republic itself, Czechia, like, dark lager is not particularly popular. It is there. It's a very small thing.
Yeah.
You can find it, but it's usually going to be Budvar's, and it's, you know, it is not really what a lot of people drink. And so it becomes a pretty narrow kind of niche-y, you know, thing. And then you niche it out even further between some of these distinctions that you're making. Talk to me a little bit about that.
So we were making Cherné Pivo, black lager, since 2012. And that's kind of gone, it's gone through a lot of recipe and process changes over the years. But for the last, you know, I think 6 years, it's been relatively the same. You could argue it has a little bit more roastiness than what the Czechs have. Some of that is because they don't use all dark malts. Sometimes they use an adjunct to get the color. But that's been a very popular beer for us. And then
adjunct, what do you mean?
Cinnamar.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I talked to Jeff Bagby about that a while back. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's malt.
Sure.
You know, it's just, you're adding color and not using dark malts. So, but even in our Cherné, we never put, this is kind of a German thing. I think it's kind of a Czech thing too, based on my experience in schooling in Prague. You know, we put all our dark malts in the lager tun. We don't put it in the mash tun. We certainly don't decoct our dark malts, because you're going to extract bitterness and things that really aren't pleasant. So, you know, typically there's a low level of roastiness as opposed to like an English, you know, dark beer, in Czech and German lager, which I like, it just because it gets in the way. But, you know, our Cherné has a little bit of roast to it. Our Tamavi is the dark malts are, because it's a dark beer, and Tamavi is dark, Czech's black. So it has less amount
of dark versus black. I'm splitting some hairs here.
Yeah. Well, you put them up to a light and you can see it's very clear, and we use less amount. And the malt bill is a little bit different too. Our Cherné Pivo is a third Pils, third Vienna, third Munich. And then our Tamavi is half Munich, half Vienna. There's no Pils malt at all. And just to give it a little bit of a different flavor profile. But the reason we did two is that I think part of this was like, when Czech beer started to get a little bit of play, Tamavi all of a sudden became very popular, right? And Cherné wasn't being talked about. And I was like, God damn it. Like, we've been doing this for a while. We're not getting any like recognition. So it was probably my like, you know, ego that got in the way. I said, fuck it. We're making a Tamavi too. So we made a Tamavi just so we could get some recognition that, hey, you know, raise our hand. We've been doing this too, you know? So yeah, that was probably my ego beer.
Interesting. So talk to me a little bit about that, you know, that louder process then with dark malt. So they're not going through that mash. How much are you then using in that kind of louder process? And, you know, what are they at that point? You mentioned you're getting some roasty flavor out of it. So it's not just color addition at that point.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. You're definitely getting flavor out of it. You're getting flavor. You're getting some aroma as well. The idea is, again, by the book, is that you're not extracting out unwanted tannins from the malt. We use a dehusk version, you know, and I find that if you use dehusk or husk in the lager tun, it doesn't really matter because there's not an intensive mash that it's going through. It's not going through a decoction. And, you know, when I brew it, I just throw it right on top of the lager tun because it's kind of fun to watch at 30 minutes into the runoff that you all of a sudden your sight glass is black when it was like amber for like, you know, 45 minutes.
Right.
So it just, you know, it just, it basically comes through a sparge. Once you start sparging, it starts coming out. And, we just found it's a repeatable way to get good color and flavor and, you know, not going through the decoction because it's the flavor we want.
Sure. Well, any other, elements to the way that you make those dark lagers that vary between your Cherné and your Tamavi? I mean, I guess what you use for dark malt, is that the same between the two of them?
We just use less of it. We use the same type of dark malt. We just use less of it. And again, the base malt, we don't use Pils in Tamavi, just to give it a different character. And again, it was just like, all right, we're going to make something pretty similar. Let's give it some variance, right? Yeah.
Are there, you know, some specific Czech beers that you were using as models for these?
The brewer Bernard, I don't know if I even pronounce it correctly because no one talks about this brewery in the Czech Republic, but they're a wonderful brewery. They make a really nice beer and they have a great Cherné, which is probably a little bit less roasty than ours. I just thought it was a really nice, you know, Czech black lager, and that was kind of my path, because there's also Kozel, I don't know if you're pronouncing that correctly either, but Kozel has an old school one that is back sweetened. And so the beer's finished, but then it's dry. And so they want that to be sweet. So they actually back sweeten it. And that's a very old school approach to dark lager in the Czech Republic. It's terrible. Like, it's you have to really, sure, I don't like sweet, you know, and so it just doesn't, it's not my thing. I can't deal with it.
Yeah, you know, again, brewers make decisions they have to make in order to sell those beers. There's certainly a, you know, a commercial element to that. And if they can sell a sweet dark beer, then they're selling a sweet dark beer.
Yeah, it's worked for them.
Yeah. What are some of the other parameters of your Chardonnay and your, you know, Tamave in terms of, you know, bitterness and how hop flavor balances out with the malt in those?
Yeah, we don't try to make these hoppy at all. Right. I mean, I think that, you know, that at that Plato, you know, they're both, you know, 12 Plato beers, and at that level, like, you got to be really careful with the hop character. You can maybe a little bit of aroma, but you know, that's not really what you want out of the beer. Yeah. So you know, we try to make sure that it's well balanced. You know, trying to sell a 4.5% dark lager was a challenge for a long time, and the people just didn't understand it because you know, we were in the age of really strong beer, dark beer, imperial stouts in the United States, and dark meant a certain thing. And, you know, dark lager at a modest strength was an outlier.
Right.
So we wanted to make it full, but finish not sweet. And that's, you know, there's a balance that goes there. You know, both of these are double decocted. They're definitely, you know, got a long rest, you know, at the alpha. And they, you know, they present themselves as an easy drinking dark lager. Mm. And that's an oxymoron to a lot of people.
Sure. Well, before we finish up, I want to talk to you just a little bit about, you know, continue the hops question there, because your 12 degree, you know, as we were drinking some earlier, you mentioned you hop with Sterling. Your 10 degree is hop with Saaz. The 12 degree is hop with Sterling. You know, talk to me about how you approach Czech hops. Obviously, anyone making Czech style beers, looking at last year's harvest and some of the challenges that the Saaz crop had, you know, it's pretty familiar with, you know, the impact of climate change on hop growers in the Czech Republic. I found it interesting that you're making your 12 degree with Sterling and trying to find a different approach to that. How are you both managing through the challenges within Czech hops now, but also finding ways to build flavors that work within what you're trying to achieve using hops that aren't from the Czech Republic?
Yeah. So let's start with the Czech hops first. And that, I'm not sure if you're a non-brewer, you're real aware of this, but the climate conditions and the recent weather in the Czech Republic has not been advantageous for some traditional hops, particularly Saaz. Czech growers typically don't irrigate, you know, so they're left at the whims of the season and how much rain they get, or, you know, you lack of or too much of. And the hop samples we've been getting for Saaz in the last couple of years have been really dire. It hasn't been great. And we've been able to get some that we enjoy, but we've had to diversify quite a bit to make sure that we get quality hops, but we can't get them in the volume that we want. So we make sure the beers that have Saaz have Saaz. And then we've had to move away from some beers that have Saaz to Sladek, which is a Czech hop. It's also Czech for brewer. Mm-hmm. So that hop is really wonderful, but you know, it wouldn't be a one-to-one substitute. But we have used it in a lot of beers and been really, really happy with it. Sterling, you know, for our standard was something I chose way before we had an issue with, you know, getting, you know, poor quality hops from Europe, or a challenge to get good hops in Europe, I should say. And in 2016, the standard is something I formulated. And I was really going at, if I'm being honest, I was really going at a kind of a Pilsner Kell clone in terms of the specs and process and all that. I mean, not one-to-one, but, you know, it was my kind of goal to get in that range because I wanted to provide our customer something that I thought was like representative of that. So I used Sterling because I didn't want to be a copycat and just making something exactly as I thought it should be in the Czech Republic. I wanted to make something that was ours, and Sterling is just a wonderful hop in terms of not so much emulating, but being in the ballpark of the hop character you would find from a Czech or German hop. It's a lovely, lovely hop. I love it a lot. That's why I chose it.
Interesting, you know, but it's also nice to think again about not trying to create, you know, the same thing as some archetype that you're following, but also figuring out how to take that spirit of brewing and working it into making that thing that's your own.
Yeah, we want to make it our own. Like, again, we don't want to be copycats on everything. We want to make sure we know how to do it the way that the inspiration country does it. We want to deep dive into that. It doesn't mean we're going to replicate it. Again, we don't replicate arrested fermentation, but we want to understand how it's done so then we can take it and make it our own and present something that we feel really good about that isn't just, you know, riffing on someone down the street. We want to make sure it's, you know, what we've done and we feel proud of it. And, but it has, you know, some degree of, I don't know if pedigree is the right word, but it has some degree of place. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Well, let's zoom out here at the end. Last time we talked 3 or 4 years ago, when I look back at the conversation then versus having this conversation now, we look at how many more beers brewed in this Czech lager style are now being made by brewers out there. It's been pretty incredible to see just how that interest has grown, how knowledge about how these beers are brewed has grown, and watching this kind of experience. We now have, you know, not just Notch making Czech style lagers, but number of other lager brewers around the United States making Czech inspired lagers, some almost or entirely focused on only making Czech style lagers. It's kind of a wild landscape now compared to what it was when you started going down this road.
Yeah.
What's your perspective on that? How do you, you know, and where do you think brewing goes next?
I think this is all brewer driven, right? So if you look at the breweries that are producing Czech lager, I mean, good ones. And I want to say there's a tremendous amount of great lager being produced right now in the United States. Fantastic, really well done German and Czech lager in ways we haven't seen for a long time. I know I harped on some other attributes that I didn't love so much. I mean, you know, I was taking the ones I don't like. There are a lot of great brewers right now.
It has never been a better time to drink great craft lager in America than right now.
And I think it's brewer driven. And you see the breweries that are doing really well with it. They're brewer owned and they're making some really fantastic, you know, lager because they have the commitment to it, right? And there's no one telling them you can't do that because you're going to tie up a tank, or you can't, you know, source these ingredients that are more expensive, or this isn't going to play well with our tap room customers because they don't understand, you know, how to say Desika, or, you know, any of these other variables that if you are a marketing owned company, you wouldn't have a chance, you know, because the beers aren't going to sell through quick enough. So I think a part of it is it's brewer led. To me, that's the best. Anything that's brewer led, whether it be hazy IPA or Czech lager, if it's brewer led, you're going to get some really good results. You're going to get people who are really passionate about what they do and put their best foot forward.
That I agree with, and I think it's also a great place to bring this episode to a close. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive 1 free year of remote control and monitoring. Schedule a time now to meet with ProBrew at CBC booth 1783. Old Orchard is the go-to source for fruit-forward ingredients for some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape. Omega Yeast Diacetyl Knockout Series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. ABS Commercial are proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country. If you're a distiller or curious about it, check out the Craft Spirits and Distilling podcast. SS BrewTech is dedicated to an engineering-first approach to brewery equipment and powers R&D at some of the world's greatest breweries, and build consistency with a reverse osmosis system from uswatersystems.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, go to beerandbrewing.com, click on that subscribe button, and you know, you can go back into our magazine archives, read the feature that Joe wrote on Czech brewing that Chris was responding to and that has spurred on this conversation. Of course, it's if you are currently a subscriber, it's all right there for you, both in print as well as on our app, as well as via PDF through the website, because we try to make it as easy as possible for you as a subscriber to read the content that we create for you. Beerandbrewing.com, click on that subscribe button and do it. Chris, if you want to learn more about Notch, taste some of these beers that we're talking about in person, or otherwise get to experience you both in the digital world and in the real space, where do they find you all?
So our main brewery is in Salem, Massachusetts. And then we have a satellite location in Brighton, Massachusetts, which is a neighborhood of Boston.
Cool. As always, it's a joy to talk to you. I love digging deep into some of the wonkier brewing processes here. Cheers.
Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.